This evening we're going to continue on with the third of the three pure precepts, do good for others. In one sense, any kind of dharma, it's very difficult to take any particular element of dharma out of the whole package of dharma and talk about it. And this is particularly true with regard to the precepts. The precepts themselves are, in some sense, a whole package. Although you can go a long way with just the three refuges, and you can go a long way with the 10 precepts, and you can go a long way with just the three pure precepts. But it is really helpful to think of them as being aspects of a whole kind of practice. And so when we talk about the three pure precepts, it's hard to not talk about the other pure precepts. And in one sense, they're all about the same kind of thing, which is paying attention to the moral aspect of our fundamental mind and the moral aspect of causality, of cause and effect. So, the third pure precept goes, do good for others, and Dogen's commentary on that is, be beyond both the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves and others. In one sense, this precept is talking about our bodhisattva vows and how or the bodhisattva aspiration, how we train for both self and others. We train not just to benefit ourselves, not just to kind of create enlightenment for ourselves, but how to see that we are not separate from the world in which we live. We're not separate from the community in which we live. We're not separate from the world itself. And the bodhisattva vows are helping us to focus on that principle. The bodhisattva vows go, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth, I vow to realize it. So they're fairly big. In terms of this precept, well, again, all four of those vows pertain. And in one sense, with the bodhisattva vows, we can't keep one vow and not keep the others. You can't really save all sentient beings unless you are working really hard on transforming the passions, transforming greed, hate, and delusion within your own mind. You can't really save all beings unless you're really kind of working on understanding the Dharma completely, the teaching of what the Buddha passed on, what the Sangha and the followers of the Buddha learned and pass on. You can't really save all beings until you have, in some sense, worked on your own awakening. And in terms of the Dharma, the saving of all beings is to help beings to awaken to their own true nature. It is not seen in... It is good in Buddhism, it is good, seen as good in Buddhism to help beings in whatever way we can. If someone is hungry, we help to feed them. If someone is in need, we help them in whatever way we can. The ultimate expression of saving sentient beings is helping them to awaken to the true nature of existence. And then, as we study the Dharma, we realize that in some sense, There are no sentient beings and they don't really need our help. And so we come to realize that the willingness, the intention to save sentient beings is about us and is about helping us to let go of our self-obsession, helping us to let go of our self-involvement. When we start thinking about others, it's a step away from being all wrapped up in our own kind of thing, whatever that thing is. So, all too often, it should be pointed out that when we set out to help others, what we're really doing is setting out to help ourselves. And I don't mean that in a kind of positive sense. I mean, somebody is doing something which is creating suffering, and it bothers us. So we want to change them. We want to help them. And the way we're going to help them is to get them to stop doing the thing which is creating suffering that bothers us. You see what I'm getting at? Most of us are not as extremely mercenary as that, but there is some element in it often of our intention to help others, which is really, how do I make the world nice for myself? And we need to kind of look at that and own up to it. And we do that by, again, examining our mind and seeing what is really going on, what is our real motive here, what is really moving us to act. It may well be compassion. We have compassion, love, and wisdom within us, and compassion is a living thing. But oftentimes, the example of compassion that we see, that the Buddha is pointing out, is the willingness to sit still in the midst of suffering. Compassion, the word itself, compassion, means with suffering, calm with passion suffering. So the whole thing about compassion is being willing to be there with suffering. And sometimes when we sit still in compassion and look at it with wisdom, there isn't something to actually do. We just sit still in the midst of it. In one of the commentaries in one of the older versions of the three pure precepts, it goes, cease from all evil, do only good, purify your own heart. And so what I'm talking about at this point is really looking into our intention. What is our intention for helping others? Is there some kind of self in there? And really beginning to look at those motives and begin to let them go. And I'm not trying to say don't get out there and help, or if you think, oh, I have an impure motive and a thing seems good, I'm not trying to say don't do it necessarily, but more to really look carefully at what your real motives are and really look carefully at the consequences of our actions, the real consequences of our actions. It is better, Reverend Master Jiyu used to say, to err on the side of action than on the side of inaction. And this is true with regard to this precept of doing good for others. And we can bear it in mind that our primary good that we can do for others is to clarify our own mind, is to look carefully and see what's greed, hate, and delusion doing in our own mind, what is really going on in there. And there is an active component to it. We are doing good for others. In her commentary on it, she starts off the commentary by saying, do not set the wheel of karma going for someone else. Do not do that which will cause others to create karma. Do not do that which will cause others to start the wheel of karma rolling. So we need to really be careful what we do. If we have an idea of a thing which may be ambiguous in terms of the 10 precepts, which may seem like a good idea, but when we really sit still with it, give that kind of hunch, man, this isn't really a good way to go, we can actually start suffering for someone else. My grandfather had this thing where he was a man who had a lot of dreams and ideas about stuff. And my brothers and I would go and visit him when we were quite small, and he would spin this story about building a bunkhouse. He lived on a ranch, he raised horses, and so he would spin the story about this bunkhouse that he was going to build and get us all excited about the prospect of this thing. And then we would go home and be talking about that, and nothing would ever come of it. And it was kind of, when we finally realized, he had no intention of building a bunkhouse. It was really disappointing, and disappointing that he would, I don't know, disrespect us in such a way as to kind of make up this story. It was kind of fun. I'm sure at the time he thought, wouldn't that be fun? Although I don't know whether he had a real intention of making the thing. It's not a super big deal, it's nothing, but it does create this kind of disappointment. There is a kind of disappointment in that. We would get all excited about it, and my mom would say, well, you know, wouldn't put too much, you know, don't invest too much in that idea. And of course we didn't, and my mom was kind of wise in that respect and knew her dad and all that stuff. I'm not trying to say he was a bad man or anything, and his intention, again, on some level was positive, but in one another way, seeing myself and being able to put myself in his shoes and seeing my own habits of mine, I can see that there was another thing in there kind of twisting the matter, which is getting people to have, to create that feeling of liking him in some way, getting the kids to kind of be enthusiastic about being around him, whatever, and generating a kind of falsehood around himself. This is what I'm saying about some relatively minor example about doing things which set the wheel of karma in motion, which cause suffering for others on down the road. So we need to really look carefully at our actions. When we it is important to take positive steps in the world, and depending on who we are and what our situation is and where our sphere of influence is, that's going to change and be different for each of us. What we can do to help beings is going to be different for each of us. In the sutra one of the scriptures on Kishtigarbha Bodhisattva, the Jizo Bodhisattva, the Earth Store Bodhisattva, it says he helps us to have the ability to do good deeds in secret. And I think that there's something quite positive about that impulse to do good deeds in secret, to be able to do a good, and we do it in secret so that it helps us to find a way to not make that doing good a matter of self-aggrandizement. I've talked about this recently a bit. It's pretty important that we don't kind of send up the flag. Like, here I am, look at me, I'm doing good, being a Buddhist, I'm cool. I remember one of the monks from years ago used to say that at Shasta they had this thing they would talk about a purple plate that people would kind of wear as a halo. sort of a manufacture a halo for ourselves, and they would, I think it was a joke they had, they would give people this purple plate when they were kind of being a little bit holy. And so I think, you know, I think it's kind of important to really look at ourselves. Spiritual practice isn't about, you know, kind of making a more marketable me. It's about really digging in and looking, what are my motives? What's really going on? What's really kind of going on? When one of my favorite teachers since passed away, Reverend Master Chushin, used to say, the longer he practiced, the more he felt like he appeared like an ordinary person. And I think this is a very important kind of quality to have. And he was great. He was always had a smile and a laugh for people. And he just was a regular person when you met him. And yet he's clearly quite successful in practice in his own way. So Dogen's commentary, Be Beyond the Holy and the Unholy. We in our efforts to do good in the way that we can, we go beyond the holy. We just do what needs to be done, sometimes in secret, without calling attention to ourselves. And we go beyond the unholy as well. We let go of our sense of idealism about, you know, there's no sense in trainees who are successful of withdrawing the hem of their garment when they, you know, keep their robes out of the mud or whatever when they get around certain kinds of people. We see someone who is in a state of distress, and there can be a kind of sense of, oh, they're kind of messed up and I don't want to have anything to do with them. I'm not trying to say we should enter into breaking the precepts to help beings. We need to be very careful about that, because that in itself can start the wheel of karma rolling again. But also we can hold a little bit too tightly to our idealism about how practice can go. And when we hold tightly onto it, it can give that sort of sense of being superior. And so we need to go beyond the unholy as well. Be willing to just deal with what there is. And the more deeply we look at our own self, the more deeply we need to accept those aspects of ourself which are difficult to accept, which are in some sense unholy. Because of our effort, we will be able to accept that more readily. Because of our willingness to let go of our judgments, this is good, this is bad, this is holy, this is unholy. On the back of the lay minister's turquoise roksu, doesn't it say, that which is true is greater than that which is holy? Yeah. Buddha nature contains everything. And that's a challenging teaching, which we have to learn about as we go along. It doesn't mean that anything goes. It doesn't mean that anything is permissible. There's a lot of merit in keeping the precepts and looking at the precepts and carefully working on that. But it does mean that there is a way in which we can really accept what is fully and not be worried about it and not be swayed by it, and learn how to work positively with it. we don't have to set ourselves apart in some sense. I think that's what I have to say about that for the evening. Any questions or comments or thoughts?
Can you give an example of doing too much and breaking the precepts?
Sometimes, see if I can think of a concrete example. Sometimes people are deeply convinced that they are unable to find peace, to live life successfully, and this is manifest in a kind of desperate need for people to help them in some way. And there's a story, I can't remember where it was from, of a monk whose mother was deeply attached to him. And he was a monk, and so he lived apart from her most of his life. And at the end of his life, end of her life, toward the end of her life, she would kind of follow him around a bit and try to kind of spend time with him and stuff like that, but he was kind of, you know, stay away. The end of his life, well, I don't remember that part of it, whether he was just kind to her and just dealt with her or whatever, but at a certain point at the end of her life, she was desperate for his company and was calling out for him. Please come and be with me. And he knew from his religious practice that it would not be helpful for her if he was there. This was a thing she needed to do. She needed to let go of him, and this was a thing that she needed to do on her own. And so refused to go to her on her at her death. And so she, in fact, died in a state of despair. But because he refused to go to her at that time, he became aware that she had let go of something in that process. The pain of it made her see something that she hadn't seen before, and she was able to let go of something in the process of dying and moved on to a better rebirth. Now this is a hard story, a story which is maybe not terribly practical for most of us, but it does give the point that it is possible for us, and he was wise, and so he didn't give in to that unnecessary request for him to be there. It is possible for us to We kind of recognize internally that a thing just doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem good to do. And yet someone is desperately asking us to do that thing. And we can kind of go along with that thing and do that thing. And then we realize later that was a big mistake. I'm thinking of somebody who I know who has a tendency to not really take responsibility for themselves, and they kind of constantly want other people to do stuff for them, and they're in a situation where, on the surface of things, it can seem quite reasonable to do something, except that you find yourself doing stuff for that person, and then you're enmeshed in a whole kind of program that he didn't really sign up for and is really not your responsibility. And so there's an example, again, not very concrete, but this is the real world, and I'm not kind of want to reveal everybody's stuff. So there's an example of, people can give off this sense of desperate need, and we have to be able to say, no, I can't help you in that way. And so in that sense, doing good for others is not doing. I've said this before, and forgive me, and maybe even in this series of Dharma talks, but one of the monks was a social worker, and in her office, there was a sign that said, "The helping hand strikes again." And even among people who are in that kind of helping profession, there is a recognition that our impulse to do good, and we have that notion of being a do-gooder, which everybody kind of goes about, so we have a sense of what that is, where someone is just trying to do more than is actually necessary, and we just have to pay attention for ourselves when we might be doing that, and really again look at the actual consequences of our actions, and if we're kind of have blurry vision there, we can, take it up with the Sangha and say, well, here's a situation that didn't seem to kind of go as I expected, and what do you think about that? And that can help us to clarify our vision of it. Does that make some sense?
Can I tell a little story?
Yeah.
Many years ago, I was up at OSHU, and there was applying for a position in mental health to be an assistant, just to help there. And fortunately, I already had been a medic in an Army Reserve hospital unit, so I had a little experience in helping experience, not a lot, but some. And she asked me, one of the questions she asked me in the interview is, what do you think you can do for these people? And I said, maybe nothing. And she goes, oh, that's so good to hear. I didn't get the job. So.
Right.
Maybe I should say something different.
Well, I'll just get in there.
No, but there is something there. We unwittingly kind of think of ourselves as God in some way. Mm-hmm. We think we have. I mean, I don't want to confuse the matter. We have agency. We have the ability to act and do positive things in the world, but it's we're one of 7 billion, and our agency is fairly limited. The Buddha really encouraged people to see your agency as the primary area of your agency being, your power to do and to act in the world and affect the world, as being your agency within your own mind. Your ability to affect your own mind. Maybe other people have examples of situations where people have done more than they, where doing more is not good.
I'm not sure. I mean, I was married to a man who was mentally ill, 35 years.
Yeah.
And all my friends around me always said, you have to leave, you have to leave. But I didn't. And I mean, I suffered a lot, but in the end, now I feel I did pretty good for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. That's exactly the thing about not withdrawing the hem of your garment. being beyond the holy and the unholy, where there's just something there, I presume, maybe this is over-presuming, but there was something there that seemed like, well, this is kind of a pain in the ass, but I'm going to keep at it. I've made this commitment. Or
yeah, with some going away and coming back stuff, but still, I did it.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel okay about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's just what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I may have an example. Right now, I'm testing something out with my sister's cat. I live with my sister, so I kind of live with the cat, too. And the cat really likes this one toy that's like a string on a stick, and he loves to play with it. And so he would always, you know, be wanting to play whenever I was around. And I felt kind of bad, and I was like, alright, I'll play with you. And, you know, I kind of felt like, you know, why should I be so selfish and not play with him? It's not like I can't play with him. Maybe I don't want to play with him, but I can. And I was like, well, he's a Buddha, so I should offer the playing to him, you know, because I wouldn't withhold it from the Buddha necessarily. But then after a few days, he became more persistent and more persistent about playing. And it got to the point where I didn't even have time to play with him as much as he wanted. And, you know, as soon as I would put it away, it was always on his mind, I could tell. It was really bothering him. And so I kind of realized, like, this is like a spiral, you know? And I decided that maybe the compassionate thing to do is to not play with him. Or, you know, I decided, this was on Sunday, I was like, all right, 1 week and we'll play again. So he's, you know, he's still kind of been bugging through the week, but I feel like it might be more compassionate to do that, especially because he's not my cat as well, and I'm not always going to be around. So, you know, if my sister doesn't have all that much time to play with him, and I'm sitting there playing with him all the time, then when I'm not there, he's going to suffer more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the old, I don't know, cats can kind of, like, feel kind of like, oh, she won't play with me, like that kind of idea that humans get. But either way, he might suffer.
Yeah, so, and you can kind of create a situation where you train the cat to expect play, and then you go away, and then the cat's going to be a nuisance to your sister.
Right. So I'm still testing this theory out, but we'll see how the once-a-week thing goes.
Yeah, again, that's what I'm saying about, it's exactly what I'm saying about looking at the real consequences of our actions and seeing, you know, okay, well, it seems like a good idea to play with this cat, and it seems like it's a kindness or whatever, so I'll give it a shot, and then, oh, well, clearly there's something kind of about the cat that gets a bit obsessive about playing, and maybe in the long run it's really not that helpful. And so, yeah, that's just it. We just try things in the world. We're willing. We're open to the possibility, and then we look and see, what is the consequence here? What's really going on?
And really, the example with the cat is no different than how I treat myself sometimes. Because I give in to, well, especially as I've been bringing the mind of meditation to, you know, more aspects of my life, when I indulge in the things I want, the things I used to love, I notice that there they are when I'm meditating. They're right there, and they're super distracting. And it's like whatever I do just is in my mind. So at a certain point, if I want to further my practice, some of those things I've realized have been a hindrance. Those things that I couldn't have lived without, you know, 2 months ago.
Hmm. Yeah, there it is. The problem of conditioning, right there. How we condition ourselves. And I think it's kind of important, again, about the matter of being beyond the holy and the unholy. Depending on whether, I don't know what those things are, in some sense I don't really need to know, but we can look at them and in a way we can, in our effort to decondition ourselves, we can begin to despise those things which we did formerly, or kind of try to demonize them in some way and kind of push them away in that way. And in the long run, that doesn't really help. That doesn't really seem to address the real problem. So it's important to not judge those former habits or whatever in a harsh way, but just recognize, oh, well, that's not particularly helpful in terms of what I want to do now, where I want to go now. Or the future that I want to create for myself.
I have a question about the term holy and unholy. I mean, it's been around it all my, you know, that term is such a common term. And when I really think about it, I think, what does that really mean? Mm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to, well, that which is truthful and untruthful, that doesn't seem to fit what we're saying here. Mm-hmm. It is very dualistic in nature. Mm-hmm. It's another thing. So I don't, you know, I'd be interested in discussion on that one.
That's an interesting question, and it's,
because you see it in history, right? You know, recent history or current history, when two people find the same place holy, you're really in trouble.
Right.
You know?
It's true. can have disastrous consequences. Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, and I suppose I rarely there's a way of talking about a temple as being, in a sense, a Dharma gate. When I did my installation ceremony here, that ceremony can be called either ascending the mountain or ascending the gate. And in a sense, we talk about like taking the precepts as opening the gate of the Dharma. And a temple is a place where that gate is, and it's open for beings to come and go to. And where that gate enters is that place which is beyond those dualities of holy and the unholy. And it is, and when you enter that gate, or when you look into it, or maybe even if you're paying attention, there's a bit of radiance coming out of it. That radiance that we might encounter there is what often gets called the holy, where that which is beyond the mundane world has an opportunity to make an appearance in the world. And by training ourselves, there's a fellow, a monk, whose name was Mahagosananda, I think he, I don't think he's still alive, but he may well be. He was the patriarch, they called him, of the Cambodian Zens, or the Cambodian Buddhists Sangha. So like the most senior monk in the Cambodian Buddhist Sangha. And there's a story about him appearing at this conference of Western Buddhist teachers that happened at Spirit Rock a number of years ago. And he's this kind of little man, really old, he's like in his 80s. And they ask him to talk a little bit, and so he kind of goes up on the stage and he says something like, he has this kind of big beaming smile. He says, "The eight worldly conditions never go away." The eight worldly conditions never go away. And he just kind of grins and then walks off the stage, and that's all he says. The eight worldly conditions are praise and blame, gain and loss. There's two more pairs like that, which I can't.
Joy and sorrow.
Anyway, they're like that. and when monks that I know were there talk about that, they get this kind of like, you know, like, this guy, he just kind of gave off loving kindness. Like, it was just like kind of coming out of him.
Yeah.
And they get all kind of excited about it. He didn't say anything, you know, say anything. It was profound. It's quite true. We need to pay attention. The eight worldly conditions never go away. But clearly the effect of him, in a way, continuing to open up that gate, step beyond the holy and the unholy in a deep way, made him into that kind of appearance of that which you, that radiance that we see through the gate. So in the best sense, in one sense, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the holy. And that holiness is, as I say, beyond those opposites of our ideas of holy and unholy.
How does that correspond with what you were saying a little bit earlier about people just appearing as ordinary beings in the world as they go on in training, and yet there is this sense that some people that have trained very deeply, while they're ordinary in the sense of being, you know, very approachable and friendly, there is this sense of radiance and holiness about them, which seems rather extraordinary.
Yeah, and the monk that I was talking about who said, "The more I train, the more I just appear to be an ordinary person in the world," had a bit of that radiance about it. And it was because he was continually letting go of any sense of, "Look at me, I'm..." "Look at how cool I am," or "This is me," or any kind of self. And Mahagodasananda, in some sense, just was it was as if he were just, from my understanding of the story, he was just kind of a regular person who just didn't take himself very seriously. He just kind of got up there on the stage and he said this thing, which sounds like, oh, this is a thing that might be helpful or whatever, you know what I mean? And so there's no need to put on airs, there's no need to add pretension, there's no need to add trying. And he just accepted himself as he was. Another story I remember hearing about another senior monastic in Malaysia who was one of the senior Theravadan monastics in Malaysia, and one of my teachers met there, and they went and visited him, and he was sitting there reading a newspaper in the afternoon, and he had a dog on his lap, a little dog on his lap, and the teacher said, "Well, it was like my teacher said he was one of the most radiant people that he had ever met. And yet here he was flagrantly breaking a couple of rules in the Theravadin practice. He was not supposed to be petting, having a pet. He's not having this dog. And reading the newspaper, it's not what you were supposed to do. Clearly he was just like appearing as an, like I say, ordinary person, just doing what needed to be done. And also, kind of that, if you see what I'm getting at. And again, I'm not trying to say, we should break the rules or not break the rules. It's more a matter of really, again, looking at our own mind and not worrying, in a sense, whether we look good or whether we look right or whether another person looks good or looks right. More, what is really going on internally? Am I keeping the precepts as profoundly as I can? Am I letting go of self? Am I looking at my motivations and really digging into that? Am I really practicing right here where I am now? Am I just letting go now?
It's my feeling the word holy has a little smell to it.
It does have a little, can do, yeah. So we don't tend to emphasize it. It's like we don't, in our tradition, tend to emphasize awakening as an experience or kensho or something like that. It's more we just emphasize doing the practice. And when you just do the practice, work on yourself, these things happen, they kind of come and go, and they're not the important thing, the most important.
Your story about the Cambodia Master, I think it's some way to look at it, as he was saying, these eight conditions never go away. Like, I'm still dealing with them.
Yeah.
And we are, and in a way, in doing that, he's sort of saying, we're all dealing with them, including me.
Yes.
So there was this encompassing feeling about what he said for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all here to train.
Right.
In a sense.
And we don't ever...
And I'm not above that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We don't, through training, we don't ever... While we're human, we don't ever not become... We're never not human.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Like arrive, like done.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Polish my halo. Reverend Master Jiyu always used to say about the Buddha, he always carried his begging bowl and, did his meditation and wear his robes and carry his begging bowl to the end of his life. And even at the end of his life, he had eaten that meal. That meal is kind of weird. He takes this food which he knows is going to kill him. So it's complicated. That's just a kind of complicated thing. He knows it's going to kill him, and he knows that there's... Anyway, it's just complicated. It's like he takes it because he knows that it's not good to refuse an offering. He takes it because there's merit in making the offering the final meal to a Buddha, and at the same time, he knows it's going to kill him. So there he is. He's got to keep training and doing his practice.
I feel like you hit it on the head with a hammer earlier when you were saying that holy and unholy are dualistic in themselves. And I think that's kind of the paradox of Zen, at least from where I'm sitting, that as soon as you think you're holy, you've lost it, whatever you had. As soon as you've forgotten about holiness at all, then you've gained everything at that point.
if we just keep forgetting about it.
Right, yeah. And it's kind of the trouble with those words, is like as soon as you say holy, you've created unholy, you know?
Yeah, and again, that's why I'm kind of saying we just emphasize practice. We just keep doing practice and don't worry so much about what we're going to get from it, whether we're going to become any particular way. Just keep going into practice, doing practice, and there is a kind of contentment that arises with that, a kind of happiness and contentment that arises with that. Oh, and that's what Dogen is saying. Training and enlightenment are one thing. We just learn to be, as long as we're training, we're giving expression to enlightenment, whether we realize it or not, whether we're awake to it or not. And there is a kind of deep satisfaction that arises from that. Okay. Satisfactory?
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much.